Okay, welcome back. I hope you're all well caffeinated now and we're ready for the next section. So I'm going to continue on this topic of getting sources into alignment. And now I'm going to talk about the source modeling piece. Now remember, the difference between the source model and the schema matching I just talked about is we're not going to make the assumption now that we have all the data available to actually do the mapping. Right? So, alright, so there's really, in source modeling, you can think of this as two steps. There's first what we're going to call semantic labeling, which is classifying the input and output semantic types, right? So if I have a source, right, like a web service, and I can pass it some piece of information, and I get back some information, then the first thing I need to do is to actually understand what that information that is, what's the information that's passing into and out of the source, what are the semantic types of this? And there's been a set of work on this, on sort of doing this classification of the inputs and outputs. First there was work done by Nick Kushmarek and Hess on metadata-based classification of the data types, where what they were using was essentially a very coarse kind of classification where they were using the overall properties of a given service, like all the names associated with it, to sort of say, well, this is a service that sells books, this is a service that sells flights, and so on. So it's a very coarse-grained kind of classification. There's some work that Dong and Halevi did that was published in BLDB on, again, doing this metadata-based clustering of the data and operations, where they were trying to take different services and cluster them together and say, okay, all these services are doing the same type of thing. But it wasn't really fine-grained modeling. And then more recent work by Learman and myself and a few others was on learning the semantic types, and this was published in AAAI 2006. And this, the problem was really to actually understand the individual fields that were getting passed in and out of a given service. So you could say, well, this is a phone number, this is a name, this is an address. And this is really required for the second step. Okay, so the second step is not just to understand what the information that's getting passed into and out of a service, but also to actually understand what the service does, right, at the functional level, right? What's the, you know, if I pass in the name that I'm going to get back, the phone number, right? So to actually understand the mapping from the inputs to the outputs. Because it isn't really enough just to understand that, okay, this returns a, you know, web service might return a temperature. You'd really like to know what the temperature means, right? What's the representation of? So there was some early work on this by Perkowitz and Etzioni that was published in HK05, where they were also doing something similar, but they were doing it for a very limited set of sources, and the types of things that they could learn was somewhat limited. And then more recently, a PhD student of mine was looking at this problem, Mark Carman, and he just finished his PhD thesis on this topic of actually learning the actual function of the surface. And that's, I'm going to briefly review some of this work here that Learman did, and then I'll talk about the work that Mark Carman did on this. Okay, so. So let me give you an example to start. So here I have three known sources, okay? And all of my source definitions are going to be in terms of data log. So basically the first source here says that, okay, given a zip is input, and the dollar sign here indicates that it's a binding constraint, meaning that you need the zip to be input to the service, then it's going to produce the Latin long. I mean, it's going to generate Latin long, and what it's going to produce is the Latin long is going to be the centroid of the zip code. That's the middle point of the zip code, right? So a zip code in the United States defines some area, and then the centroid is going to be the centermost point given that area. The second source is one that takes two lat longs and generates a distance. So, and it just computes the great circle distance between these two lat longs, which is, you know, the distance, you know, on a globe. And then the third source is going to take a distance as input and produce a distance as output, and what it's doing is converting the first distance in kilometers into miles. Okay. So those are the three known sources that we have. And then a new source comes along, and all we know about this new source is it has two inputs, and they're called start zip and end zip, and it generates some output called a separation. We don't know what these things mean. So the first step, which I just described, was classifying the input and output semantic types essentially what we're going to do on the inputs is to use the metadata, which is essentially the labels, because that's all we have, right? So far, we found this service, and we don't know anything about it. We've never executed the service, we've never seen anyone execute the service, so we don't know anything about it except that it's got some, you know, what's called a WSDL description, WSDL description, that describes what the service is, but it describes it in a syntactic way. There's no semantics associated with it. And so the first step then is to try to associate those input terms with something that we already know about. And so using the essentially the metadata associated with it, which is the WSL description of this service, then we might decide that those two inputs are the zip code. Then we can classify the output using the combination of the metadata with the labels and the descriptions of the service and the data. Because now once we know what the input is, then we can generate some data. We can try to generate some data as output and then actually look at the data to see what that is. And so we might decide that, okay, this separation looks like a distance that we've seen in other sources. So then once we have essentially done the modeling of the type, then we can go to the second step, which is to actually model the functionality of the service, okay? And we do this through a series of steps where, you know, the original source, I don't know if you can read it very well in this projector, but, you know, this is the same source I showed you before. Source 4, which we know has two zip codes as input and generates something called a distance. And then we want to generate some kind of plausible definition. Now this definition, I'll describe how we get to the definition, but the definition is in terms of the other sources. Right? Because what we're really trying to do is generate something that relates to things that we already know about. But given that we know what these other sources were doing, we could also describe it in terms of these other descriptions of these sources. So it might be, so the one hypothesis might be that, okay, this source 4 computes the centroid of the two zip codes, computes the great circle distance between those, and then converts them into miles. So this great circle distance computed in terms of kilometers, then it converts it into miles. So it's essentially producing the great circle distance in miles between two zip codes. Okay. So the way this is going to work in terms of the basic approach is that it's going to generate this plausible definition, and then in order to test whether or not this definition is in fact the correct definition of this service, we're going to actually compare the outputs they produce. So one of the reasons we produce the results in terms of the other known sources is so that we can actually compare them. So here, remember we have a set of sources from before, source 1, 2, and 3, were all known sources that are services that we could actually execute. And so the idea then is we're going to generate some sets of inputs, and then we're going to run them on the actual sources, right? So we can actually run them on the three known sources. And then we can run them on our source, which is, we're predicting it's going to actually produce the same result. And so then we can compare these, right? And so and if they match within some bound, we can decide that, in fact, this is the correct definition of the source of the service. Okay. All right, so now let me just go into a little more detail about how this actually works, right? So that essentially is the approach, right? We're going to model the different inputs, model the inputs and outputs using a combination of the metadata and the data itself. And then we're going to come up with some kind of definition of what the service actually does, and then test it against the known services to see if, in fact, it produces the same results. So the first approach, then, in terms of, the approach to doing the semantic labeling, the modeling of the inputs and outputs, as I said, starts with the metadata, right? So we do this metadata-based classifier. And the idea is to exploit these kinds of descriptions. So this is an example of what the WSL file actually looks like, right? So it has some operation, and might take things like an input and has output. And the idea is to actually use all the different terms that are being mentioned here to look for other things that we've seen in the past that are similar to try to make some prediction about what these inputs are. Then the second piece is this content-based classifier, which what it's going to do is actually take the data itself. So from known sources. So we have a set of known sources that already have things like zip code, latitude, temperature, humidity. So then when we see a new source that produces similar kinds of data, then we can do this content-based classifier and say, oh, okay, I recognize this. This is a zip code because I've seen it in other sources before. And so the new service comes in. You pass the metadata in. Once you make some prediction using the metadata-based classifier on that, for example, this is a zip code, then we can actually generate some example data from other services we know about, and then pass that example data back into the service to then generate some output data. So we actually have real outputs from this. And then we can run both the metadata and the output data through the content-based classifier, and the metadata-based classifier, to generate the set of labels on the inputs and outputs of the services. So then the second piece, and I'll talk a little bit more about how we do the functional modeling piece now, is we're going to basically search through this space of plausible definitions. And this search space is very large. This is very much If you're familiar with inductive logic programming, where you're trying to learn sort of a programmatic definition of something, you know, described in data log, similar kind of search. The assumption is a little bit different here, but it's similar kind of search in that we're generating a set of plausible descriptions of the actual service, and then what we can do is score these definitions by comparing the outputs they produce with that of the source that's actually being modeled, right? Because we're going to generate the definition in terms of known sources, and then we can compare the results. So here's sort of a picture of how this works. So we have some example inputs, a set of example inputs. We're going to invoke the new source, and we're going to generate some set of target tuples, right? So you have the inputs and the outputs, basically. And then we're going to generate this definition of this new source, and then the definition is written in terms of known sources. So then we can execute the known sources, generate some set of candidate tuples, and then compare the outputs. So the first step then is invoking this target. So we have this new source 5, right? So it may take, you know, a zip and a distance as input, and it generates a zip and a distance as output. And what this may be doing is generating all zip codes within a particular distance, and what it's returning is the zip code and the distance to that zip code. So it's going to, since we have a hypothesis that it's taking a zip and distance as input, then we're going to generate a set of input tuples, right? We know about zip codes, we know about distances, we can generate a set of examples of these things. And so it's going to invoke the source with some set of representative values and randomly generate these input tuples. If you know the distribution of the input tuples, then you could use that. And then it's going to generate some set of outputs here. So we have the inputs, and it's going to generate some set of outputs. And hopefully we're going to get some non-empty results. If we only get empty results, then there's probably a problem either with our generated inputs or with our conjecture about what the inputs are. So if no output is produced, then you're going to try invoking other sources to generate some set of legal inputs. Then what happens is it goes through a sort of a best first enumeration of the candidates. So we start with this empty clause, right? Source 5 with no parameters. Right, and we're basically going to we can do a couple different things. We can specialize it by adding a predicate from some set of sources, meaning that we can say, well, source 5, we can try to define source 5 in terms of source 4, example, right, where we can relate the terms in source 5 to these other sources. And then we can check that each definition is executable and not redundant. Not redundant is important because once you start, the search space is large, and so if you start generating redundant definitions, then it gets even larger, and you don't want to do that. So you're going to go through this search space of generating these possible definitions from known sources, and then you're going to evaluate the leaves of these definitions to find the one that, you know, gets you does the best in terms of predicting the outputs from the inputs. And then you're going to refine it further. So then you're going to take that, if this is the best one, source 5 defined in terms of source 4, then you're going to expand that further. Because notice here that we only have a definition from the first parameter to the third and fourth. We'd like to include this, and so you're going to expand it further to see if you can take this into account to actually understand what the different parameters actually mean. So, you know, there's different degrees of actually learning this definition, right? So, you know, we may be able to learn part of the definition of a source without being able to understand everything that it's producing. The goal is to learn it all, of course. So once we go through that sort of generation phase, so we have a set of candidates that we've learned, then we want to evaluate the candidates. And that's going to involve comparing the output of each candidate with that of the actual target. So here we have the inputs. Here we have the target output. And here we have the clause output. So meaning, in one case, we're actually evaluating the actual definition against known sources. In the other case, we're actually executing the service that we're trying to model to see what it produces, and then we're comparing the results. So here you're going to have some cases where there's no overlap. But remember, we're not assuming that either source is complete. So we're only looking for some overlap between these. And so here we do have some overlap. And if you look at the papers that Mark Carmen did on this, he goes into great detail about how he actually does this evaluation, given the fact that the overlap, you know, you don't have 100% overlap between the sources. Because that just wouldn't happen. You're not going to get, unless it's the same source, you're not going to get exact overlap. So let me now give you, and all I've done really is just to kind of give you a flavor of how the learning is actually done here.
For the parameters that aren't labeled yet, do you just pick random
Well, let's see. No, it's a really good question. It turns out that you're going to have to come up with a definition. Before you can even test the definition, you're going to actually have to have all of the input parameters labeled. So it doesn't, it does not, I believe, pick random values. It's going to come up with an initial definition that comes up with some set of inputs, the outputs. But there are many cases, and we'll see on the next slide, where there's a large number of outputs. So, and a good example might be something like Yahoo Weather, right? I give it a zip code, and then it generates 20 outputs. And in some cases, you just can't figure out what all of those outputs are, but you can figure out what some of them are. So. Okay, but the basic idea here, right, that we're, what's happening is that we're essentially learning the function of a service in terms of a set of known services, and then we're executing them and comparing the results to figure out whether or not they actually match. Here's some examples of actual learned examples by the system. So the centroid one, which I showed you, is one that it did learn. So it takes the two zip codes and generates the distance of the centroid to those two zip codes. Here's an interesting one where it learned that it could use a USGS site, the US Geological Survey elevation site. It could learn a definition of the USGS elevation site by using several other sites it knew about, which converted feet to meters, and another site that actually gave you the altitude of your particular location. Yahoo Weather, it was able to learn a definition from Yahoo Weather in terms of a weather forecast site, and another site that gets the city and state for a zip code. And one of the nice things it was able to learn is actually distinguish the forecast from the current conditions. So remember, if you're looking at something like Yahoo Weather and you just look at the semantic types, then you're going to get things like temperature, wind speed, those kinds of things. And if you just stopped at what Christina Lehrman had done in terms of actually understanding that this is a temperature, it's actually not enough to really make use of the site, right? Because you really want to understand the difference between a forecast and the current temperatures, right? They're both temperatures, but they mean very different things and be used in different ways. Here's a nice one. So there's a get quote site that Mark was able to learn in terms of Yahoo Finance and another site that would get the company name and then, you know, some simple addition operations here. And it was able to learn some interesting relationships between these two. So for example, it was able to discover that the current price was equivalent to yesterday's close plus the change since yesterday, which, you know, it's obvious when you say it, but it's nice the system could actually come up with those kinds of relationships. And then Yahoo Autos, it was able to learn in terms of Google-based cars and some other conversion things. And this one's kind of interesting because, you know, what happens in a lot of the cars, you know, that get posted on the web is they get posted in multiple places. And so, you know, one of the things the system's able to exploit is the overlap between those different sources to actually understand the relationships between them. So these are just some examples of the kinds of things the system's able to learn. One thing I want to mention about this work is that, okay, so there's this assumption, which is a strong assumption about this overlap between the new sources and known sources. Because what you're saying is that, okay, we're only going to learn source definitions, in some sense, if we already know the source about these sources or about this data. But there's a number of ways in which this work is actually quite useful. So let me just quickly review these. So first, there's sort of the redundancy issue, which is that, you know, okay, I already know about Yahoo exchange rates, and a new source comes along, you know, Bloomberg currency rates, and I can learn a new source, about a new source that I could then use, and this is particularly useful if, you know, Yahoo exchange rates goes away, right? So now I have other redundant sources that I can use, or it's unavailable for whatever reason. Another example is in terms of the scope or completeness. So maybe I already know about U.S. hotel rates, and then a new site comes along, Worldwide Hotel Deals. And using what I know about the U.S. hotel rates, now I can actually expand the coverage, right? So now I can learn about worldwide hotels because there's enough overlap between the known, between the one I know about for the worldwide one that I can cover a much larger area. Another example where this is useful is in terms of binding constraints. So I might have a website that gives me hotels by zip codes, and then I have a new site that comes along, five-star hotels by state. Well, by being able to combine the different sources that I have, now I can actually eliminate the requirements that I know the zip code, and I can actually get hotels by state. Another one is in terms of composed functionality. So I may know about the centroid of a zip code, how to compute the centroid of a zip code, and I know how to compute the great circle distance. A new source comes along that I can now learn that gives me the distance between zip codes by, you know, these composed things, which may be more efficient. And then there's access time. So I might have a government hotel list, which is really, really slow. And I can learn a new source, you know, Google Hotel Search, which you know is going to be blinding and fast. And so now I can actually get, you know, much faster access to the same data. So there's a whole variety of ways in which this could be used, even with the assumption that there's some overlap between the node sources. Okay, that's the end of my session on getting sources into alignment, right? So I know enough about the model of the source to now know how it fits into my more general integration model so I can use the source. But we're not done. The problem now that remains is that, okay, I've got this great hotel source, right? I found this new source that, you know, give me worldwide hotels. But then when I look at the data, it doesn't match the data that I actually have in my current system, right? Prices are in a different currency. There's all kinds of issues that can come up in terms of the actual information that's being provided. The hotel names may be slightly different. You know, maybe they've abbreviated the names. There's all kinds of issues. So the next piece of work that I want to talk about is on getting data into alignment. Okay, and there's sort of three subsections to this I'm going to go through. First, let me talk about the general problem. So I alluded to the problem earlier when I talked about the earlier extraction work, but this general body of work is often referred to as record linkage. And the problem is I have things like restaurant records where I might have, you know, two different records here from different sources. The first one for this restaurant, Phoenix, and you can see, you know, I've got a name, address, city, phone, and cuisine. And across the board, they may be different in sort of minor but important ways. So here, maybe they've abbreviated in Phoenix. Here, it's Phoenix at Argyle. Here, the address has West on the end of the one case and not on the other case. The city might be Hollywood versus West Hollywood, which is, you know, maybe the same place. The phone number might have a slash in it one case and a dash in another. And cuisine, you know, might be one website's going to be American, another one's going to be, you know, New French. So you can see that there's a variety of differences at the data level that cause problems when you start to integrate the data, right? Because now if I ask the question that spans this restaurant, you know, the question is it the same restaurant or not? Likewise, you know, I might have things like reference bibliographic references that again may refer to the same same papers, but different in subtle ways. You know, the ordering of the names, the year. You can even get slightly different years, right? Because people often guess about what year the publication is going to come out, and then it takes longer. So there's a whole variety of issues that come up. So the task then is to identify, in some sense, syntactically different records that refer to the same entity. And there's a variety of sources of these types of variations. It might be, you know, because of the way the databases are merged, typographic errors, abbreviation, extraction errors, OCR scanning errors, and so on. Happens all the time. In the real world, it's very messy. Okay, so the basic approach really consists of three steps. First, we have to generate some set of candidate pairs. This first step is called blocking. And the reason we have to do this is that the number of records that we might have to compare could be huge, right? If I have two, you know, data sets, each with 100,000 records in it, I don't really want to do 100,000 to 100,000 comparisons, right? It just would take far too long to compare all those different records. So the first problem we have to solve is to decide what we're actually going to compare. So this first step is called blocking, right? And it's the method for actually figuring out which things we want to compare. Next, we're going to compute some kind of field similarities. And the problem here is that, okay, once I've decided which record I want to compare against which other record, now I have a set of fields, right? Each record's made up of a set of attributes like name, phone number, street address. And what I need to do is then decide how I'm going to compare the phone number to the phone number. So we need some method of actually comparing this. So for example, it might be string similarity could be used to compare the individual fields. And then finally, there's computing the record similarity. So once I compute the field similarity, that tells me the individual how the individual fields compare. Then the question is, how do you combine all the fields into a record similarity to get some overall estimate for how well these records match? All right. So let's first talk about the blocking, which is the generation of candidate matches. So here, let's assume that we have two databases. One's the census data, another one's the database of AI researchers. And you can see we have the first name, last name, phone, and zip. And the actual matches, you can see, are highlighted here. So you have Matt Mickelson to Matthew Mickelson, and here we have Joe Smith to Joe Smith, or they spelled the name wrong. But you can see there's some overlap, and we have things like zip codes. Notice all the zip codes are the same, and phone numbers on these, which are pretty good matching. And then, you know, some of the names match, but there's some spelling errors. So in terms of approaches to blocking, there's actually been a variety of approaches. So, you know, one approach is to sort the neighborhoods on what are called block keys. So you take some field and you sort it and then group it. Another method that Andrew McCallum came up with is called the canopies method, which is, again, was doing some kind of clustering over the different kinds of fields to decide which ones are likely matches. Some more recent work by Belenko was doing what he called DNF blocking, which was essentially learning a blocking scheme for the records. And then some work that I did with Matt Mickelson was also doing some learning blocking schemes. And this was published in 2006, IIII. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about this last approach. So the basic, first some general terminology. So most of these systems do what's called multi-pass blocking. And the idea is that you're going to come up with a set of rules that essentially describe records that are likely to be the same. So each pass is what's called a conjunction. So for example, I might say, well, one way I could do the matching is to take a combination of the items that I'm comparing. So I could compare either at the entire field level, I could compare at the token level, and then I could compare any of the given fields. So first refers to the first name, and phone refers to the phone number. So this is a method where I say, well, I'm going to compare the first name at the token level and the phone at the token level. And the combination of these gives me one sort of rule for doing the blocking. And then I can combine these different passes into a disjunction. So I can say, well, I'm going to first look at the last name at the token level and see if they match. And then I'm going to look at this the conjunction of the first name at the token level and the phone at the token level. And so this generates, you know, a set of disjunctive normal form rules that form what we call a blocking scheme. Right? So the blocking scheme are essentially these rules that the system can evaluate and generate the set of candidate matches. And then the question, well, okay, so let me show you an example of this first, then I'll show you the interesting questions about this. So the example is, so here's, this slide just shows two different blocking schemes. In the first one, we simply have a single conjunction of the last name compared to the token level and the first name compared at the first letter, right? So in this case, we're going to Mickelson and M to M, and those are going to match. In the second case, we're going to compare Jones to Jones, and Jim Jones and James Jones are going to match based on this blocking scheme because they both have the shared J in the first letter, but they're not really a match, so that's really going to be a false positive. The second token, second blocking scheme here is just to compare the at the token level the zip code. And in this one, the zip codes, remember, are all the same, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And so the first one's going to be a match, but these are also going to be matches, but these are also going to be false positives, so they're labeled with X's. So you can see that, you know, what you're trying to do is, remember, the blocking scheme is just the first step in actually doing the record linkage. This is the step that generates the set of things that you're even going to consider. So the question we want to ask is, well, what are the important properties of a blocking scheme, right? What do we actually want the blocking scheme to do? So there are two properties. The first one is called the reduction ratio. So this is essentially, well, let's see, first some definitions here. So we have two data sets, S and T. So the reduction ratio, and C is the set of candidates that you generate. So the reduction ratio is going to be 1 minus the size of the candidate set that you generated over the cross product of S and T. So the, you know, because that's essentially comparing, you know, the worst case is we compare everything to everything and across the two data sets. So the question is, given this blocking scheme, you know, how much have we reduced it, right? How much we'd like to make this as small as possible, you know, as small as possible module of the second property. So the second property is what's called pairs completeness. So if we have if SM is the number of true matches in the candidates, right, we've generated a set of candidates, and this is the real matches, and NM is the true matches between S and T, then pairs completeness is SM over NM, right? So we'd like this to be as close to 1 as possible. So some examples. Let's take the two blocking schemes that I just showed you a second ago. So the first blocking scheme was compare the last name at the token level and the first name at the first letter level, then the reduction ratio here is 0.78. So, you know, that's pretty good. So we get a pretty good reduction. But the pair's completeness turns out to only be 0.5, meaning that if you think about it, the pair's completeness at 0.5, that means we're only getting half of the actual matches in our candidate set, which means the best we could possibly do in record linkage would be 50%, right? Which is not good. It's not good, right? Because you really are, you know, striving to, you know, get close to 100% as possible. So you'd be really bad off if you started with a blocking scheme that only gave you 50% of the candidate matches. Now the second blocking method here, which was just looking at the zip code. Now it turned out that every zip code was the same, okay? So the reduction ratio is basically zero. We didn't get any reduction at all. That's not so good. But the pair's completeness was perfect. We didn't miss a single one of the possible matches, so we got a one for the pair's completeness. So this isn't so great either, right? Because we actually, the blocking did us absolutely nothing. We've wasted time doing blocking. We could have just compared the cross products. So, but you can see, these are the two properties that we're trying to maximize. We're trying to get as high of reduction ratio as possible, but at the same time, keeping the pair's completeness as close to one as possible. Okay, so how do we do it? So as I said, so we want a small number of candidates, so it means we have a high reduction ratio, and we don't want to leave any true matches behind, so we want a very high pair's completeness. So prior to the work that Matt did on this, pretty much people were doing fairly ad hoc approaches. You know, each paper that wrote about record linkage was essentially invented on either a new method or they just compared everything. So he developed a system that he calls the blocking scheme learner, which is a modified sequential covering algorithm. And the idea is to learn this restrictive set of conjunctions. You essentially want to partition the space, minimize the set of false positives. So you're going to essentially union these, you're going to generate these conjunctions which are going to minimize false positives but give you, you know, cover part of the set. And you're going to cover, you're going to cover some set of the, well, you essentially want to cover all of the training matches but minimize the false positives. So since you've minimized the false positives, the conjunction should not contribute many false positives to the disjunction. Anyway, let me show you by example how this actually works. Well, here's the algorithm, but I think I want to do it by example rather than go through the algorithm. But the basic idea is that you're going to do this multi-pass idea, right? So remember on the first slide I said, okay, well, you know, most of these blocking methods do this multi-pass blocking where you learn a conjunctive rule, you apply that, then you apply another conjunctive rule. And so what you're going to do is learn these conjunctions one at a time and then union them together, and they're going to cover all of the training matches to basically maximize the pair's completeness. And so here's the sequential covering algorithm, which I'm going to cover by example. So the learn one rule, so what you're going to do is go through this sort of general algorithm where you learn one rule and you add it to the disjunctive set, learn another rule and add to the disjunctive set, and so you maximize the pair's completeness. So you're going to do this general to specific beam search where you're going to keep adding new attribute method pairs until you can't improve the reduction ratio and you satisfy sort of a minimum pairs completeness. So you might start a search like this where you say, well, okay, let's consider adding token zip and see how that does. And then we can add a conjunction with the token last name and then evaluate that and add another, you know, whatever the next thing is. And so you basically learn one of these rules. And let me show you how this would apply in an example. So let's say that here are the actual matches, right? The green showing the actual matches. And the first rule that we might learn might be something like zip and token, right? So we're going to, for the zip code, we're going to use the token match. And that's going to generate this large set. But you can see this isn't so great because in addition to the actual matches here, we're getting all these false positive matches. So then we can refine this rule by saying, okay, well, let's turn zip code and first name based on token. And now we can actually eliminate a bunch of things in the set that aren't relevant but still keeping all the green elements in the set. So that might be one rule. But then we're left with these real matches that we haven't actually covered yet. So then we might learn a second rule, which is last name with the first letter. But that still has... And then we can refine that with the first name with the first letter so that we end up with that set of matches. Um, So then we end up with the final rule, which is the first rule we learned, unioned with the second rule we learned. So as you can see, it captures the actual matches with sort of minimizing the number of false positives it's going to generate. So the key here in a blocking, instead of blocking rules, is to learn a set of rules that are going to give us, that are going to find the actual matches somewhere in the set. But we can still have these other false positives in there. We just don't want to have too many, because then we can run the next two steps in the record linkage. Okay, so he had some experiments, and actually it did very well. I mean, but basically, you know, he compared it to some existing systems, HFM, which, you know, had a really low reduction ratio. He compared it to William Winkler, had some work where he actually was doing this manually, and so he was showing here that it was actually very competitive with the you know, human generator rules. And then it was comparing it to some other systems like Marlin, which I'm going to describe next, which in that system had a very, you know, 55% reduction ratio. So it had to compare a lot of matches. So as the data sets get large, it becomes a big problem. Okay, so that's basically the method for blocking. So now I want to talk about, one method for blocking, there's some other ones, but now I want to talk about field matching, approaches to field matching. So there's a variety of approaches to field matching. If you look at the commercial world today, there are systems that commercially do record linkage. They tend to do this for specific domains. So they tend to do it based on company names, people names. A good example is LexisNexis, for example, has a product that does this. And the basic approach taken in these products is to use essentially a sort of an expert system style rules where they've constructed, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of rules that actually describe how to actually do this sort of matching across fields and stuff. They're good, but they're very limited in the sense for, you know, what they've been designed to handle. So they're very, very domain specific. Other approaches include approach developed in a system called Whirl by William Cohn on doing token similarity. And the idea is to use sort of TF-IDF kinds of methods to compare things. The next one is string similarity. So this I'm going to describe next, but the idea, this is used in a system called Marlin by Misha Belenko and Ray Mooney. And the idea here is to actually look at strings and look at sort of edit distance between strings, how close they are. Then there's other work. This is a student of mine who worked on a system called Active Atlas, Sheila Tejada, who basically came up with a set of domain-specific transformations that could be applied. And then more recent work by Steve Minton et al. In learning these sort of heterogeneous field matching kinds of systems. But I'm going to focus just on two. I'm going to talk just one slide on the token similarity, since the idea is quite simple but nice. And the idea is to basically evaluate the similarity of the records using this sort of textual similarity. So any string can basically be treated as a bag of tokens, right? So you can take, you know, the string address and then just convert it into individual tokens. And then it follows the same approach that basically is used by classical information retrieval algorithms. If you're not familiar with it, these are basically the algorithms that are used in search engines. So Google would use something that's at least based on TF-IDF, but it's probably no longer TF-IDF. But what you do is you essentially apply stemming, so you're getting rid of all the possible sort of suffixes on the different words. And then the entities are compared by counting the number of words in common. But you don't just compare by number of words, because the is a very frequent word. So you infrequent words are basically weighted more heavily by this TF-IDF metric. So TF-IDF stands for the term frequency divided by the inverse document frequency. And so what that means is, you know, you have a set of documents and you weight all the terms based on the frequency that they occur in these documents, and then you give higher weight to the infrequent words. So what that means is, if you have two records that you're comparing that have a number of very infrequent words in common, then you have a much higher degree of belief that that's in fact a match. So that's a very general approach to doing this. But the other approaches I want to talk about are string methods. So the basic string edit distance method was developed by Levenstein in 66. This has been around for a while. And basically the idea is to look at the minimum number of character deletions, insertions, or substitutions needed to make two strings equivalent. So, you know, how many, you know, misspell with, you know, one less S on that has a distance of 1. Or misspell to misspell is a distance of 2, because you can delete the S and substitute P with T. And so on. So you can have these sorts of edits. And this can be computed efficiently using dynamic programming in basically order m n time, where m and n are the length of the two strings that you're comparing. And you know, typically what happens is the unit cost is assigned to individual edit operations. But you could have individual costs, so delete and insert could have different costs. Then a refinement of this is to basically use string edit distance with affine gaps. So this is work by Gotha. And the idea is that the cost of the gaps are formed by contiguous deletions and assertions, which should be lower than the cost of multiple non-contiguous operations. So for example, if I'm relating misspell to misspelling, you know, you don't really want the cost of that to be 3, because the fact that, you know, I have ing that are all inserted together, that seems to be very different than if I had 3 letters inserted in random places inside the word. So this sort of edit distance with affine gaps is more flexible and less susceptible to sequences of insertion and deletions, which are quite common in, you know, many of the kinds of text that we're going to look at, like things like street, str. Those kinds of abbreviations happen frequently. Okay, so then Belenko and Moody came up with a learnable edit distance model with affine gaps. So they developed a system called Marlin that used this. And so the idea here is just to take this one step further and basically they want to basically learn the significance of the edit distance, edit operations, since they're very much, you know, they very much can depend on the particular domain. So, you know, substituting slash with dash is insignificant for phone numbers, but it may not be in other kinds of things that you're comparing. Or deleting Q, you know, it might be very significant for names. So you may want to take these different kinds of edit operations into account. And the gaps, start and extension costs may vary. So, you know, for street addresses, you know, these kinds of things are okay, but they're very uncommon for zip codes. Right, you know, deleting numbers of zip codes, that might be a bad thing. So the idea then is to learn these edit distance things with the affine gaps and come up with the appropriate weightings based on the particular attributes that you're comparing. So here's an example of this, right? So if I'm comparing misspell to mistelling, here M is the matching or state, D is the delete state, I is the insert state, and hash is the pound state. And so you go through and you compare these things, and you can see you could basically go through this model and generate the edited the mapping between these. And then what you're trying to do here is learn the weights on the different states, on the different transitions between different states, so that you can actually come up with a good evaluation for how close these two words are. You know, in the original work, it was just unit costs, but now they come up with a learnable model to basically learn these costs. Okay. So to train the system, what happens then is you essentially give the system some large set of examples from a given domain. You give it the labels on those, and they use an EM or expectation maximization method to basically come up with the model parameters, to basically learn the weights in the different models, so that frequent edit operations and typos have, you know, high probability. Rare edit operations have low probabilities, and gap parameters take on values that are optimal for things like duplicate strings in the training corpus. Once you've trained this system, then you can run, you know, on-scene examples and come up with better estimates for how close the different things are. And so this computation is basically performed using a simple dynamic programming algorithm, the computation of the actual cost between two strings. Okay, so that's the field method. Those are the sort of the approaches for doing field matching. Are there questions on that? So essentially I talked about a range of sort of different types of approaches to learning string edit distances. So there's many other methods for actually comparing fields, but that's one that actually works quite well. Are there any questions on the field matching before I go on to how we use this in record linkage? Okay. So for record linkage then, the problem is, okay, so some fields are going to be more indicative of record similarity than others. For addresses, you know, street address similarity is more important than city similarity. And the reason is that in places like Los Angeles, you know, you have Hollywood and Los Angeles, which are actually the same thing as far as the post office is concerned. And so you can get records that in some cases will be listed as Hollywood, in other cases Los Angeles. So how close those names are, in fact, isn't a very useful measure. But it turns out that the actual street address itself doesn't matter what city you put. I mean, the street address always is the same. So some things are more important than others. Another example of this is for bibliographic citations. Author, title similarity are more important than the venue. So what you want to do then is weight the different field similarities to combine them to determine the overall record similarity. And these weights can be learned using some learning algorithms. There's been a variety of work that have looked at different ones. Let's see, the next slide, I have sort of different approaches. So, for example, William Winkler and others have been looking at a variety of sort of unsupervised record linkage approaches where they use things like EM to actually come up with some, you know, just weights without any training. But what usually happens in these systems is that there's a set of matches that they have a very strong belief they're matches, a set that they believe are definitely not matches, and a set in the middle where they have to have someone label them. So even though they're unlabeled, they have an expert usually look at the end result. There's things like merge, purge. There's been some work on database hardening by Cohn. Decision trees, so this is some work that was done by a student of mine, Sheila Tata, using decision trees for actually doing the matching. And then support vector machines by same work I was just talking about by Misha Belenko and Ray Mooney, and some recent work by another student of mine on object consolidation. But I'm going to talk about the support vector machine work here. So here, the basic idea is to basically take the string similarities for each of the fields as components of an overall feature vector for the pair of records. So you're basically going to take this support vector machine and train it on a set of labeled feature vectors to discriminate the duplicates from the non-duplicates. And then the record similarity is going to be based on the distance of the feature vector from the separating hyperplane. So I think I have a picture of this, but in SVM work, go here, what you do is you're essentially learning what's called a hyperplane, which sort of separates the matches from the non-matches. And so you can then use the distance from the hyperplane to help you figure out whether or not it's a match, which side of the hyperplane it's on, and how far it is from the hyperplane. So we did learn these set of features, okay, so these might be like the string edit distance or any other feature here, but you have the set of features for each of the different attributes, right? And so you have these learned distance measures. You're going to combine them together into some kind of feature vector, and then the support vector machine then, given this set of feature vectors, is going to then do the classification. So there's a training phase where you train the support vector machine, and then a classification phase where then when you pass it the values, it says it's a duplicate or not duplicate, meaning it's a match or it's not a match. So here's a detailed example of this. So we have two strings we're trying to compare, 3130 Piedmont Road and 3130 Piedmont Road Northeast, right? So these are the two strings we're comparing. So they get broken out into the set of vector pairs that you're going to compare. So you and what's going to happen here, this sort of shows the hyperplane here. So S and D are the duplicates and non-duplicates. And the question is, you know, for a given set of features, you know, where does it fall? If it falls over here, then it's not a duplicate. If it falls over here, then it's a duplicate. And then this distance sort of gives you some sense of the similarity between the strings. So that's a very brief overview of sort of the work on record linkage. But the idea here is that you have a set of technical choices in record linkage, right? You have some approach to blocking, some approach to field matching, and then some approach to actually how you combine the fields to the overall record linkage. And so if you look at all the papers, it's sort of a nice way to sort of organize the different pieces of work. Because the different papers on record linkage, you know, tend to focus on, you know, one or two of these aspects. But the interesting thing is they can be combined in different ways. So people tend to build a specific system with, you know, one approach to each of these, but in many cases these approaches can be combined. And the learning approaches here, which a lot of people have looked at sort of specific learning methods, have the advantage of being able to adapt to specific application domains. You don't have to sort of hand tailor to a particular domain in advance. You can learn which fields are important, and you can learn the most appropriate transformations for that given domain. Often the optimal classifier choice is going to be sensitive to the domain and the amount of training data available. Right? So that's going to depend on, you know, if you have lots of training data, then you might use one approach. And if you don't have much training data, then a different approach might be appropriate. Okay, so I think now we're going to turn it back over to Rao, who's going to talk about, now that we have extracted the data, figure out how it relates to the model, and figure out which records actually correspond to which other records, now Rao's going to tell you how you actually get the answer out.